through our courting that I slowly turned his house into our home, shedding a bit of light and softness to his darkness. But I was aware it was his home, and I didn't want him to feel out of place. So the parlor is decorated more for him than myself. I do have a touch of femininity around the bay window that overlooks our back garden. I do try to show my womanly side. It was Lisbeth's suggestion that I put the star jasmine in to cover the mouldering sandstone back wall. She is such a romantic, suggesting that at night when the vine was in flower, we could sit out there and be swept up in its heavenly scent. And we did, and still do. When there is a light breeze blowing, the scent wafts through the parlour to the main dining room and the sitting room, a welcome relief from the pollution of London and the smell of sewage from the river. I will miss pruning the star jasmine, my meditation, especially when I have writer's block or I need to think something through. Nate stands watching from the back veranda, then a deep masculine chuckle escapes him, bringing my attention back to reality, to him. His smile can unblock anything. He always says, "You'll cut right through that wall one day." The first time I exhaled on seeing him was not out of love or admiration. It was out of frustration. I had attended the rally against the South African War. Many opposed the British presence there. Papa was speaking at the protest. He had been very vocal in his newspaper articles, but he used a pseudonym so as not to be arrested. But today at this rally, he was going public. The military sent a clerk as a representative who would also have the opportunity to respond. I was appalled on seeing Sergeant Nathaniel Clintoff. He looked like he'd had a rather late night with his shabby appearance, and he reeked of alcohol. He fell asleep partway through my papa's speech, but blast it, I couldn't take my eyes off him. A lost soul, I thought, as I watched him limp around the grounds when he had the energy or ambition to get up and hand out the army's pamphlets that outlined their position on war. But my pity was short-lived, as I found out he was from an affluent military family and should know better and have more respect for himself, his family, his purpose and job. Feeling warmth on her toes, Louisa is roused from her thoughts. The sun's first ray has finally spilt across the garden. She hears the pitter-patter of little bare feet and the hushed dulcet tones of her husband talking gently and encouragingly to their son. On seeing his mother sitting in the morning light, the boy runs to her open arms and she sweeps him up, devouring his chubby cheeks with kisses. Nate stands back marveling at this beautiful sight. What a vision to wake up to, he thinks, as he leans in to kiss her good morning. His stomach churns with hunger and excitement for the journey they're about to embark on. I'll prepare us something to eat. It was Louisa who had persuaded Nate to take up the offer to travel to a faraway land. It was like a fairy tale. What an adventure! She could see his soul dying, even though he had worked tirelessly on his dark place. Melancholia was his mother's preferred word. It came from the injury he'd received in the South African War, shrapnel ripping through the thigh of his left leg and rendering him unfit for action. Reassigned to clerical duties, which he hated, he'd been chained to a desk for 8 years by the time Louisa marched into his life. He gives thanks for that every day. She was his ray of hope, his reason to live and crawl back from his darkness, which at times rendered him disabled. There were days when he could not get out of bed, but that hasn't happened since they married, 5 years ago now. In the first 2 years of their marriage, Louisa organised adventurous trips to the countryside, and during this time, Nate worked his way to sergeant status. It was her encouragement that led him to take up the offer of moving to Australia. The new upholder of Her Majesty's law for the newly formed town that had been a trooper's outpost in the snowy mountains of the Alpine country. Why not? Louisa had squealed with excitement when he first broke the news of the offer. Think of the adventure. Think of the control you can have. Not sitting at a desk filing paper after paper. A man of the town, your town, bringing law and order, building something from the ground up. Nate, how wonderful! Nate could only smile and admire his intelligent, beautiful wife. He knew she was right, and this trip would be perfect for his soul and sense of pride. As he justified his own thoughts, Louisa was talking at 100 miles an hour, flitting around the room, her arms waving with a light skip to her step. God, he loved her. He always cringed when he thought back to their first meeting, at a rally where her father had spoken. I was still drunk from the night before, and probably smelt like the whores I had bedded. Anger, hate, and self-pity had raged through me since my return from South Africa, and the only way I knew to deal with it was to drown it with alcohol and mind-numbing romps in filthy sheets of sin and bed mites. I'd been existing under a dark cloud for years, consumed by self-loathing. On a few occasions, I did need urgent medical attention. Miraculously, I was revived and walked straight back out to the closest inn. I felt her looking at me, but I didn't care. I was used to people staring and tut-tutting their disapproval. But when I did catch her eye for just a fleeting moment, there was something in it that sent a charge through my body. I sat bolt upright as if struck by lightning, but she was gone, lost in the crowd. It was only later I saw her again, standing alongside her father after his rousing speech against war. Then I knew it would never work. I come from a strong military family. Me, my father, and my older brother, we all fought side by side in the Transvaal Rebellion, each of us receiving medals of bravery. The Boer War was our father's last hurrah, and after my injury, mother swore there would be no more fighting for anyone, prompting my two brothers to take to the land. Father could still get his kicks, as mother put it, and remained close to the military by attending military functions. So my mother dearest was more than happy that my new position in the military was to sit behind a desk. It wasn't until everyone had left the rally, and I was cleaning up my station, and she, her parents, that we bumped into each other, with our heads, to be precise. We both bent to pick up pamphlets from the ground. She called me a big buffoon, and all I did was laugh, which of course was the wrong thing to do. But I finally managed to say I agreed with her, and if she would do me the honour of joining me for dinner, I would sincerely apologise for my buffoonery and make up for the lump that was swelling upon her pretty forehead. She blushed a stunning powder pink, tightened her lips to a pout, slammed her hand on her forehead and marched off. I was instantly in love. For the first time in 8 years, there was a lightness in my soul. The bacon fat spits, hitting Nate's bare chest and bringing him out of his thoughts. Piling three plates with fried eggs, bacon, and the last of the bread, he joins his little family on the back steps in Greenwich for the final time. Louisa keeps Samuel occupied with stories of what a grand adventure they will have on the high seas to a land down under called Australia. It was when Louisa and Nate were checking the world globe in the sitting room that they came up with the phrase down under. Louisa had put herself in a rather awkward position to see, her hair cascading to the floor, blood running to her cheeks. She had tipped herself upside down to read the globe as to where exactly Melbourne was, saying, "It's kind of down and under, isn't it?" Her nose twitching with curiosity. She stood up too quickly and fell into Nate's arms, and they laughed. "We might fall off if we're not careful," she had proclaimed. And this morning we were about to set off on that very trip, down and under, and I pray we won't fall off, or that I won't fall back into my depths of darkness. My fear is normal. It's all right to be afraid. It's all right to have high expectations of what I am required to do, and it's all right to not reach them, as long as I have goals and try. This is my mantra to keep my clouds of doom at bay. Louisa came up with them. I'm not sure they work, but what I do know is that at the end of her proclamation was her smile, and that is what I think really works. but this morning I will keep my thoughts of despair to myself. Breakfast complete, their bathing and personal hygiene attended to, there is a knock at the door. The footmen have arrived to load the last of their trunks and the three of them into the horse-drawn carriage and take them on their final journey through the city streets of London to Portsmouth, about 60 miles away, for their departure. Louisa sits forward, perched at the window like an excited child. I don't know whether it was from sheer delight and excitement at our voyage that lies ahead, but the city of London is filled with an energy I haven't felt before. The buildings aren't so daunting and dark, the low clouds not so heavy and dreary. People walk with a skip in their step, and some even turn to smile at us as we go, moving down the cobblestone streets. Samuel is on Nate's lap, looking out the other window, waving at people as we pass. Every now and then he cheers and giggles at whatever Nate is whispering in his ear. Nate bounces him on his good knee, and every time there is a bigger-than-normal bump in the road, Samuel is bounced into the air. Oh, what joy to hear my son and husband laughing and cheering. Our carriage comes to an abrupt halt. Both Nate and I stretch our necks to see why. We have time on our side, so it isn't too much of a worry. Nate places Samuel in my lap and leans out the window to speak to the footman at the back, who is positioned slightly higher. I can't quite make out what is being said. Nate sits back down and informs me as he takes Samuel that there has been an accident ahead. A cart has overturned, there is someone hurt, and produce all over the street. We could wait until it is cleared, or we could take another route, not one favoured by the rich or those with precious family possessions. If you go there, particularly at night, you will surely be robbed. But since it is 8:30 in the morning, surely the riffraff are sound asleep. We choose the alternative route, not wanting to risk waiting until the cleanup is done, just in case it takes longer than expected. We are to depart on the SS Aberdeen, a triple expansion steam engine single screw. That is what Nate told me. Having no idea what that meant, I nodded enthusiastically as he briefed me on our seaworthy carrier's details. She travels at 12 knots, capacity is 695 passengers, and the ship, she, as he fondly calls her, as if she were an acquaintance of ours, was just refurbished last year, 1892. And she, the SS Aberdeen, will be departing promptly, whether we are there or not. To sit and watch a clean-up would therefore drive me insane this morning, so we opt for the back roads and laneways as the better option for our sanity and adrenaline. As we start off again, I decide to check the map of the route we will take to get to Australia. I need to find some focus. We are to head down the west coast of Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope, and then east to the Australian west coast, then further down and under the country. Knowing the world is round, I still can't help imagining us falling off its edge. The voyage will take approximately 8 weeks with favourable winds. We will be travelling first class courtesy of the British Army and the Victorian and New South Wales governments. Our voyage is a direct sail to Melbourne. We have been warned that we will encounter some rough and dangerous waters, especially in the Bass Strait, the last leg of the home stretch. It thrills me, but it also puts the fear of God through me. Once again, our carriage is stopped abruptly, but this time by the low, gruff voices of men in the lane outside, which make this stop far more worrisome than the first. I have a feeling that this encounter will not end well. Nate quickly swings Samuel to me, at the same time drawing the blinds. He delivers a quick, curt instruction to get down and stay down, and then he is gone. There is an inaudible exchange of words, and then I hear the scuffle of feet and a commotion, thumps and bumps at the side of the carriage, heavy grunts of exertion. But as instructed, I stay down and stay put. Besides, I have Samuel to think of. Damn it. The bastard caught me on the blind side. The footmen have squared up to the other two men who came at them from the sides, out of the darkened doorways of the alleyway. I'd hoped these thieving lowlives would be sleeping. They demand our trunks, and today I'm just not having it. And a good fight to settle the nerves feels right. I can see they have no weapons and are not your robust, burly type. They're wiry and young and would normally be the lures or lookouts. Maybe they thought they could impress their lot with a morning haul. Bastard! Another hit to my ribs. I come back with the left-right and body blow combination. This bastard can fight and is going toe-to-toe with me. Time for something drastic. This is taking up our travel time. I pull my pistol and they back off quick smart. One of the footmen has been knocked out but is slowly coming to. They drag off one of their own who hasn't fared so well either. We help our man up and onto the back of the carriage and move off, taking the first right turn we can to get us out of the laneway for fear they may go and get help, or worse still, weapons. What a bloody fool I am. I didn't consider hard enough the safety of my wife and son. What if... Oh, I can't even bring myself to think it. We make haste and are now back on the main road to Portsmouth for our departure. I do feel better for the fight, though. I did try to talk them out of robbing us, are the first words I say to Louisa as I scamper back into the carriage. Once she has finished looking me over for injuries, she scolds me, and fair enough. Samuel, the little devil, has a smirk on his face. He knows very well what has happened. We arrive in Portsmouth and I help unload, my ribs a little sore. We board the SS Aberdeen, all very excited as we explore our room and the ship's decks. Then we set sail, pushing back from the docks, waving to others' loved ones. Samuel squealing with delight at the excitement all around him. My parents wanted to see us off, but we told them we didn't want to make a fuss, and to keep things calm for Samuel's sake, not to mention my anxiety. No goodbyes, and we are away. Everton, snowy mountains, Alpine country, the high country, New South Wales, Australia. I hope I can achieve what is required. The new keeper of the peace of the newly formed town. It was once an outpost, Crest Hill, there to uphold the law and implement legislation. A town, my town. Makes me feel good about myself. Best I have felt in a long time. Chapter 4. Our voyage to Australia was uneventful, which is probably a good thing. My right arm got a workout, though. Not through my writing, as one might think. If I wasn't patting Samuel to sleep, I was rubbing Nate's back, soothing him while he heaved into a bucket. Bless him. Nate suffered seasickness for almost the entire journey, but swore it was something he ate. It did eventually subside. Sailing the Southern Ocean along the coastline of this great southern land was the most beautiful thing I saw the entire trip. I was thrilled to think what the rest of this country had to offer. They were right about the waters of Bass Strait, but we got through and we made it to Melbourne, Australia, to the land down under, alive, and Mama, happy to report, we didn't fall off. Louisa writes to her mother from a room at a guest house in Melbourne. They're stopping here for a week before they set off on the next leg of their journey to the New South Wales Highlands. She takes a moment to think about the tasks at hand. Lots to be done. Provisions brought, collected and sorted. Travel route planned and studied. Briefings for Nate. Many briefings for Nate. And trunks and cases checked. Louisa looks out the window overlooking a park, the lace curtain moving gently in the light breeze. I do like the city of Melbourne, Mama. Lots of parks, very green with tall eucalyptus trees, gum trees, as they are fondly called. Beautiful tall trees with white and silver trunks and long, slender olive green leaves. Rather calming to look at, and something I believe is truly iconic to Australia. The trees smell amazing and are used for medicinal purposes as well. But dangerous. Their other nickname is the Widowmaker. Apparently, many a drover's wife has been made a widow before her time. Their drover husbands taking respite under such a tree to then have a branch fall and kill them dead in their slumber. I must remember that and warn Nate. I was worried about snakes and spiders, but now a tree? Oh dear. The air is fresh here, Mama, and I can see Nate's soul relishing it already. He feels so alive here. Seeing him happily organizing and being so involved is a delight. His leg is holding up well because he's been doing his physical therapy. He's got a new lease on life. And Samuel has pink in his cheeks and runs for hours when we manage to get him to a park. He takes off his shoes and just goes. The other women I have met are friendly enough and very considerate of us. But they are of the higher class. There is more wealth here than I had imagined, considering the global economic situation now. And the Australians are very loyal to the monarchy, dare I say it, frightfully more so than us. The majority of the women I have met are not as interested in the politics of the country as I would have thought or hoped, nor really stand for anything of substance. I say this with some confusion because it is Australia leading the charge in the women's suffrage movement. But then again, that is coming from the city of Adelaide, which I hope to visit at some stage. Maybe only the few I have met seem this way, and perhaps it is my arrogance towards the higher society. So I will not judge as I have been brought up not to. But I will keep in touch with a few and encourage their interest in the governing of their country's ideals. To advance and give voice to equal rights and equality for all women here. I do feel I can persuade them, though, in the future perhaps. Particularly as they are women of influence who have come from or married into money. I wonder if they would financially support my monthly women's journal idea, Mama. Perhaps that could be a way in for them. Oh, or is this my ego talking, Mama? One must laugh at oneself. Oh, dear me. Louisa pauses from her letter writing to contemplate this. Oh, the future. My future here in Australia. Australia. I would never have dreamt in a million years that I would be destined for Australia. She's roused from her thoughts by Samuel, who has woken from his nap. Oh, time for something to eat and a walk in the park. Nate should be back soon as he promised he would join them, hopefully bringing the trunk she requested. There is a ball tonight in honour of the Right Honourable John Adrian Louis Hope, the Earl of Hopetoun and Governor of Victoria, and the Honourable George Turner, MP. Prior to the ball, there is a private dinner in the Clintoff's honour. Louisa rifles through a trunk looking for a dress she often wears to occasions like this. Not that there have been many, not her or Nate's thing really, balls or fancy functions. But she is glad she packed it. She wasn't going to, but being the wife of the new Law and Order of Everton, she thought an evening gown might come in handy. What a privilege, Louisa gushes to herself. An evening of fine dining and dancing. She's hoping Nate has grabbed the right trunk from storage. At last, a final heave as she retrieves her dress from the very bottom. A beautiful red and white full-length ball gown made of a satin-cotton blend with lace trim spills from the trunk, cascading to the floor. It has three-quarter-length poet sleeves with a bow detail on the cuffs. The red satin stomacher matches the dress skirt of the gown. White satin with detailed fine red embroidery on it. The paleness of Louisa's skin, her dark auburn hair and brown almond-shaped eyes that change colour with her moods enhance and complement her dress beautifully. When she is concentrating or angry, her eyes turn to deep dark pools of chocolate. And when she is excited or staring lovingly at her husband and son in a moment of sheer bliss, they turn to a burnt toffee speckled with gold, especially when sunlight hits her face at a certain angle. Nate loves the magic in her eyes and adores her in this dress. He gave it to her for a birthday. Louisa doesn't much care for the bows on the sleeves, but she knows how fond Nate is of this gown, and his reaction when she first tried it on was so priceless that she dare not say a word about her dislike of the bows. And on special occasions, she does like to dress up and be the lady her husband needs by his side. Oh dear, she thinks. Who will help me dress? As if by some mysterious power from the other side of the city, the wife of Governor Hopeton has read her very thoughts. Lady Hersey Alice Evelyn de Molins, daughter of the 4th Baron Ventry, the footman announces on presentation of the dresser she has sent for Louisa's convenience. Louisa is very flattered and thankful for the kind gesture. Later, she finds out from the whispers of the gossiping wives of lower-ranked politicians that Lady Hopeton is known for her haughty manner. The ball is extravagant and quite unnecessary, considering Australia has just emerged from its economic depression, and especially with the ministerial instability in the Melbourne office. But Louisa does need to look the part, and besides, the Clintoffs are the special guests. But the ball is not just for them. Their arrival coincides with the announcement of the Honourable George Turner, MP, running in the election for Premier of Victoria the following year. He and the Governor are both passionate about the push for federation. Louisa exhales. Riding in a carriage through Melbourne is a delight. The early evening fresh, a crispness to the air. Her handsome husband by her side. He's done a fine job in the selection of his attire this evening, she thinks, hiring his suit himself. He looks dashing and proud, and Louisa can barely take her eyes off him. Oh, how she loves him. Later, as talk swirls around the room like the hemlines of the dancing women's gowns, Governor Hopeton flamboyantly holds court, boasting of the success of his extravagant evening. Neither Louisa nor Nate could have predicted that it will be another 7 years of hardship before their adopted country gets back on its feet. Perhaps if the ball's outlandish budget were redirected into the economy, prosperity may have arrived a little sooner. Finally, we arrive at our destination, and the footmen are run off their, well, feet. The carriages have all converged at once, following strict instructions for the presentation of the arriving parties. It's chaotic, but it seems to be working to plan. While we wait, I take in my surrounds. The Melbourne Town Hall is a large, stately building with a central body and a wing either side. The clock tower stands to the very right of the building, not central, as most are. Inside, the ballroom is very grand indeed. Elaborate chandeliers hanging from the soaring ceilings. I was not aware of the high society Melbourne harbours. A string quartet plays as we make our entrance. We are ushered straight to the Governor and Lady Hopeton. I thank her for her assistance, telling her it was as if she read my mind. We share pleasantries, but it's her husband who most intrigues me. He is wearing hair powder, even though he is not wearing a wig. With his hair receding, particularly at the sides, the powder gives his natural hair the dignified and polished look of old, living up to his forefather's dress style, I suppose, which is no longer considered fashionable. But he is the Right Honourable John Adrian Louis Hope, the Earl of Hopeton, GC, MG, and Governor of Victoria. He seems to have a young, mischievous spirit, and I like him. He says if we were staying longer, he would love to take us on one of his informal horseback tours. He and Nate, of course, speak about war, but the Governor's poor health prevented him from joining the army and seeing any action. He was educated at Eton, where he rode and was on the debating team. He then went on to the Royal Military College, Sandhurst, passing in 1879. He and Nate compared dates, finding that had Governor Hopeton been in better health, Nate would have more than likely have fought under his command in South Africa. Governor Hopeton ushers Nate away to a less crowded area for further chat. We have arrived to interesting times in Australia. There is a push for the 6 separate British self-governing colonies to unite and form the Commonwealth of Australia, keeping their own form of governance, but agreeing to a federal government that would be responsible for matters affecting the whole nation. I remember Papa mentioning this in a conversation with Nate's father at our final family dinner together. Considering the two men have totally different views on war, they get along quite well. Samuel was feeling unwell and took my attention away from their conversation. I did enjoy listening to my papa's worldly knowledge, and I will miss our talks dearly. Finding myself alone, I take in the particulars of the room. Ladies in lavish ball gowns, the fine material of the draped curtains, the polished wooden wall panels, and the design on the wallpaper. As I turn to take another drink, I meet Mrs. Rosa Morgan Turner. Our hands reach for the same glass. She observes, "There's only so long you can stand staring at and admiring wallpaper." We laugh, introduce ourselves, and then proceed to investigate each other, our husbands, and our mutual interest in women's rights. I discover Rosa is the wife of the man for whom this ball is also in honour, and that we are the special guests for the dinner prior. She is a woman after my own heart. She can see that this isn't quite my norm. The extravagance makes me a little uncomfortable, as it does her. Her husband loathes this type of unnecessary spending. The money that went into this night would have contributed greatly to the advancement of women and the women's rights movement my mama fought so hard for in Britain, and most certainly in Australia, I tell her. To my delight, Rosa agrees. She informs me of the advancement of the movement in South Australia, where women have the right to vote. I eagerly inform her of my own knowledge on the subject. She is travelling there soon, to Adelaide, for a function to help raise funds for the movement. She asks where I might be in the coming months, and to my misfortune, I tell her settling into the lifestyle of Everton, somewhere in the snowy mountains of the Alpine country. She informs me of her husband's standing, and hopes that once he is elected, he will bring light to the issue of equality for women and give them the vote in Victoria. Oh, how this talk excites me. Although Mr. Turner is considered frugal, prudent, unyielding, and self-sacrificing in his wife's opinion, it is his policy of strict economy and balanced budgets, raising taxes and cutting spending, that is restoring confidence in the Victorian people. Everyone is hurting, and they desperately need to hear from someone who has a common sense and practical approach. Will this do anything to relieve the effects of the depression, though? This is yet to be seen. She goes on to tell me that Mr. Turner is part of the Australian Natives Association. I am thrilled to hear that he is for the advancement of the Aboriginal people. As I understand, they have not been favoured or considered in the colonisation of this country. There is an uneasiness when this topic comes into conversations, and it is always quickly deflected. But to my horror, I learn that the Australian Natives Association is for white men only, and the term natives means the first generation of Australian-born white men. I have a great interest in learning more about the Aborigines' customs and plight, but I won't be talking to the Honourable George Turner MP on the subject. We assure each other we will write, and when the time comes, I will be delighted to accompany Rosa to Adelaide or work with her on forwarding the women's movement in the South. She also speaks of a small country just off the east coast of Australia called New Zealand and their progress of the plight of women. I question my forwardness, but I think, why stop now? So I bravely ask Rosa if she will consider writing a page on the function in Adelaide for my monthly women's journal. I tell her of my plans, and she does not hesitate in her reply. I would be honoured and thrilled to. I follow Rosa into the dining room, where we are placed at the opposite ends of the very long and elegantly arranged table. We bid our farewells and hope to catch up later in the evening or at another time altogether. The meal is divine, and everyone is quite taken with us. Lots of questions are asked about our plans and hopes for the newly formed town of Everton. We are told the history and the mythology of the area. Some tall tales, I am sure, but it is all very intriguing. We are also told that its wool industry has been hit hard by the Depression. When Nate can steal a moment from the bombardment of questions, he leans into me, lightly brushing my ear with his lips and sending a tingle down my spine. He whispers, "You are very beautiful tonight, Mrs. Clintoff, and I would love to take you to a darkened corridor and have my way with you." I take my serviette and place it over my mouth, concealing the wicked smile spreading across my lips. I turn to face Nate, and he becomes very businesslike. Someone must be watching. I have learnt far more at this gathering than I have from my superiors, at the meetings I've attended leading up to our departure from London and now Melbourne, he says, which is the day after tomorrow. He wonders whether they are keeping him in the dark so as not to scare him off. Maybe they are right to. If we knew of the true dire straits situation, would we have come? The one story that is repeated is to do with the unrest of the natives. Most have been dispersed, but there is still a stronghold of the last remaining tribesmen in the Everton area. With the depression reaching and affecting all, there is much crime, theft of livestock, and lives lost on both sides in payback. Frontier wars is what Nate calls the unrest. Of course, all the women gush over Nate and compliment me on my good fortune in being his wife. I tell them it is his good fortune to have me as his wife. There is lots of hidden laughter behind well-placed handkerchiefs as they float away to start other circles of conversation, throwing looks over their shoulders at me, forced smiles of endearment. Maybe I am too down-to-earth for them. But damn it, I am being me, and I won't change for anyone. At least Lady Hopeton has taken a liking to me. I head to the ladies' powder room to relieve myself and sit in silence for a moment. Oh, I think the journey is finally catching up with me. Attending to Nate and Samuel with their discomfort at sea, and now, once on land, having time to myself to let my guard down and relax a little, an uneasiness has crept upon me. The powder room has a quaint little room off to the side for my much-needed purpose, to take the weight off my feet. A divan, hand fans, cool washcloths, and cool fresh water. I utilize it well until I hear laughter and idle gossip from the stalls. Two young women are giggling over the flirtatious nature of one of their friends with the handsome British man who is going to run a town in the Snowy Mountains. I will have to plan a ski trip up that way and track him down. More giggles and carry on. I promptly exit to find my husband. One of my downfalls is that I have a tendency to be very jealous. I don't know why or where it has come from. Nate is my first and only lover. For all the time we have been married, I have not felt at all threatened. And as to why I allow that ugly green monster to overwhelm me, I have no idea. But right now, here in a foreign land, in a city where I do not have my Lisbeth for an ally, or any friends for that matter, the monster will be released to protect what is mine. I march into that ballroom with gusto. I don't intend to start any trouble, but I am determined to find this young lass and put her in her place. I don't have to look too far. I see almost straight away the band of young, pretty vultures circling my husband. The little blonde-haired lass is flirting up a storm, actually placing her hand on Nate's arm. I'm quite sure he is only being polite as he holds her gaze. Then he spies me and politely removes her hand and steps towards me as I reach the circle of lust. Gracious and calm, with nothing to hide, he places his hand in the small of my back. Darling, I was wondering where you got to. This is my beautiful wife. Half of them have left the circle by now. Louisa Klintoff. The few that remain curtsy politely, nod, and leave. Thank God you got here, Nate whispered urgently. That was getting ridiculous. Really? I say, in a tone far too harsh. Yes, Mrs. Klintoff, really. Nate leans in and kisses me seductively, putting on a show for the young lasses, and I play right along, draping my arm around his neck, staring daggers at the blonde one who cannot hide her disappointment. So much so that I burst out laughing. Nate takes me in his arms and swirls me onto the dance floor. As we glide together, he informs me. I was hoping to meet Judge Eisenmenger. He was supposed to be here tonight. He is the presiding judge in the area where Everton is situated and is looking to become mayor. So I was hoping to set up a meeting for tomorrow, get a rundown on his plans. A final briefing from him before we head off would be most welcome, since he really knows the place better than most. I do have his briefing papers, I guess. On those papers is a direct order. Go straight to the southern end of town, last house on the left, for keys to your home and your work premises, office, jail, and troopers' quarters. Father McGuinness to give further directions and instructions. Consider him the unofficial mayor of Everton. Speaking of papers, did you get the maps for our travel? I ask. We really need to set some time aside tomorrow to study them. Any lands to avoid? Dare I say it? The unrest with the natives? Nate assures me that from his briefings today, it appears as if most of the troublesome blacks have been driven higher up into the mountains. The others are content to live at a camp or reserve, newly founded at Cowan's Lake, which was renamed Blackfellow's Lake. Apart from Nate's disappointment in Judge Eisenmenger not being present, and the lusty young leeches latching onto my husband, the night is a great success, and we are glad to have attended. But we are both happy with our decision to leave when we do. Back in our room, with Samuel sound asleep in his cot and the nursemaid dismissed, Nate and I make love. With the stress and tension of our trip over here and our plans all in place, he can finally release. And release he does. Nate is a magnificent lover, very caring and gentle, but forceful and manly when required. I love our moments of intimacy, and I'm not afraid to instigate our lovemaking either. Nate gave me that permission long ago. It's all right for a woman to have these desires. He cares to make me satisfied. I dare not ask how he knows how to do this, and I don't care. I'm just grateful for his efforts and that he is mine. Our naked, sweaty bodies glide over each other with ease, hands exploring, driven by the desire to please. His arm muscles bulge under the strain of keeping himself raised above me as he thrusts, throwing his head back, burying his manhood deep inside me. Our thrusts are strong but measured. We are in no rush tonight. We both know we will be on the road for a week at least, living rough under the stars, no comfort of a soft bed, although the thought of nature being naked in the wild excites me. But tonight, here and now, we enjoy our creature comforts and relish in our lovemaking. Something has ignited in Nate, and the pleasure is all mine. Louisa fulfills me in more ways than one. With a woman I love and admire, my sexual desire and needs mean so much more these days. I am blessed and grateful. And I can't hold on much longer, but the desire in her glazed eyes cautions me to wait as I know she is close. We are both close. And tonight we will climax as one. I bury my face in the curve of her neck because her eyes are driving me wild. But her scent and then her gasp of ecstasy pushes me over the edge. I thrust deep as she lifts her hips to meet me, and finally, together, we finish in one lustful, loving moment. A smile of sheer contentment grows on her lips, and I melt into her, relishing in our afterglow. We exhale together. We kiss and separate, but I drag her into me and we cuddle, her bottom pressing firmly into me perfectly. We fit together as pieces in a puzzle do, a hand in a glove. And before long, we both drift off to sleep. Chapter 5. 2 weeks earlier, snowy mountains. Moss-covered granite boulders display a beautiful contrast in texture of softness and hardness, a precise depiction of this land and my world, the harshness of my life, cushioned by the unconditional love of my children. From the recent rain, the moss's bright green on the black-grey granite is stark, contrasting with the snow-white trunks of the white sallies scattered on the hillside. Yellowing tufts of tussock grass, indicating autumn is upon us, jut out from the boulders and rocks that form the cavernous walls to the river below, its dark water indicating its depth. My hands are red raw. I keep hitting the blasted rock. Don't know why I bother. If I scrub any harder, these blasted clothes will fall apart in my bare hands. They are not far from being called rags, but the washing needs to be done. It's been raining non-stop for a full week. The rain came from the north. Dark clouds loomed over the northern ranges for a whole week before landing and dumping on us. Last of the significant autumn rains. Today is the first time the sun has shone, and the children are covered in mud. They didn't even have to go outside. The roof is in urgent need of repair. The slat wall gaps need refilling, and my once hard dirt floor has become a mud pit. Rain from all directions. So, this morning up early, using the mud and a woman's journal, me and the children start to pack the gaps in the walls. I get the journals from a peddler. He used to come out once in a blue moon, but he doesn't come much anymore. None of them do. They know I can't afford to buy anything. They're usually old issues by the time I get them, but I don't mind. I like to read. Miss Shirley instilled this in me. "But don't be too forward about it," she cautioned. The journals are an outlet and connection to the world beyond my little home. So isolated up here in the mountains. And a learning tool for the children. They can all read and write. I made sure of that. Beside their school and purpose, the journals come in handy as gap fillers and toilet paper. I gave the children instructions the night before. When yous get up, have a little breakfast. There's dried damper there. Dip it in some black tea. You can have a bit of sugar in your teas this morning. Then I need yous to gather some sweet grass. I lay this grass on the muddy floor to soak up the moisture. Molly lies sleeping, content, a little extra sleep in, a very rare pleasure. A long, soft Hessian pillow rests under her belly and between her knees. Her breathing is gentle and even. She is woken by laughter. Her children are rolling over the sweet grass to help smooth out the muddy footprints in the once perfectly kept dirt floor, helping to soak up the excess water. It's how she gets them to do their chores without too much fuss. Turn everything into a game. The children love doing this. They love getting the mud all over themselves. Laughter and giggles sure beat the bickering and squabbling of the past few days. Wash day is always a full day. Clothes and bodies to wash and dry. Put the traps in for food. If an emu nest is found along the way, maybe steal an egg, but never two. And then time to play. Wear the children out. Home to eat the catch of the day and then to bed. Molly knows if she leaves the doors and window slats open while they are away for wash day, the floor will dry and harden a little before their return. Winter is coming, and washing in the river gets too cold to bear. It'll be back to washcloth and hot water off the stove or the hot springs. They're a short walk from the property. But she saves the hot springs for her own pleasure. She doesn't have many pleasurable moments in her life besides the joy of her children, so when she can steal a moment, she enjoys this little indulgence. She shared the springs with Danny when he was a baby and, of course, Delphi, a mother-daughter moment. But the hot springs are hers and hers alone. As they head off down the back, Danny carries a homemade fish trap. "Remind me to get some wattle on the way back." "Did you bring the tins?" asks Molly. Joe Jr. holds up four tins that once held Rosella jam, tropical fruit, and candied peel from the Hardgraves cannery in Brisbane that Joe brought back from a drove to Queensland. They have wire as homemade handles. "Best time after rain for the wattle, hey Ma?" chimes in Henry James, a scrawny little fella with hair that has a mind of its own. It sticks out in all directions, wiry like his da's. "Yes, son," Molly smiles down at her usually non-verbal son. Joe Jr. does all the talking for his little brother. Those two are thick as thieves, little rascals, but good kids in general. Wattle gum was a treat her father would give her. A gin showed him how and when to collect it, and with a sprinkle of sugar when he had it, or stole a pocketful, it made for a nice treat. Molly remembers as a little girl once demanding her da remove his pants so she could lick his pockets clean of sugar. There were holes in each pocket, so most of the sugar he'd stolen had been lost to the road on his walk home, but she licked the last of it from the cloth. So when Molly can spare it, she adds a pinch of white gold to give it a little sweetness, a nice dessert, but only if the children have behaved, and only a little. You can't have too much of the wattle gum, or you'll get a bellyache. Not a good thing to be dealing with when the women's journals are all used up on gap filler for the walls. Molly thinks, her face frowning a little. Hopefully we'll get some fish. That will do for dinner tonight. Cupboards are bare, so the catch is needed. As they reach the river, the boys jump from boulder to boulder. The banks are low and close enough for the jumping game. The boulders are majestic. So impressive, you wonder how they got there and were placed where they lie. Hadar once told her, his Scottish accent strong, that God must have put them there. He was playing marbles with his disciples. At another time, Molly told her children the countryside was once a land of giants. And just as they used small rocks to make structures, so did the giants' children with the boulders. The valley where this river runs would have once been filled with a massive volume of water. Its high, cavernous walls indicate this. And where Molly and the children wash the clothes and bathe, there is a deep swimming hole. The land opens up, and there is a bank for convenience. Granite covered in moss and white sallies form the backdrop. Now about 8 months along, Molly's pregnant belly makes washing awkward today. She sits back on her haunches, releasing the pain in her back and sighs deeply. But the noise of her children arguing breaks her concentration. She turns to face her boys, bathing in the shallows a little further downriver. Enough, you boys. Don't want to hear it? Sort it. Danny, Joe Jr., and Henry James fall silent, their heads hung low. Not today, boys. We've been cooped up in that house all week because of that blasted rain, and I listen to yous fighting and carrying on, and I just don't want to hear it. Yous can get out now and dry off. The boys get out of the water reluctantly, with a final push and shove, and under their breaths, a final blame. Each wears worn yellowing breeches, patches dominating the original fabric. Delphi looks up at her brothers from where she is playing on the bank, a cheeky grin on her face. All siblings like it when the others get in trouble. But whatever the boys have been fighting about is short-lived. New ideas for a game are passed between them as they head further downriver to the big boulders. Molly's worn hands gather up the wet clothes. She steadies herself and heaves to get up from the ground, her upper body the last thing to come upright. She grunts with the last exertion, then takes the washed clothes and hangs them on small shrubs nearby. Their brittle branches stab at her pregnant belly, breaking off as she reaches to spread out each item of clothing. Once done, she stretches her back and waddles over to a nearby tree. She sits, her hands finding the trunk behind her for support and guidance to the ground. Her back rests in a groove in the trunk. Be careful. Play safe, stay close, no yelling, and watch out for your sister. Cute as a button, Delphi plays by the water's edge with her rag doll and makes mud cakes for a tea party. She is in a world of her own, lost in her imagination, oblivious to what is going on around her. I'm having a nap, and I don't want to be woke until I wake, Molly tells the children. They all chime, Yes, Ma. Molly settles back into the tree. Every part of my body aches today. I'm exhausted. This baby is draining the living daylights out of me. It has been a trying few days with the constant wet weather and four young, bored, hungry children. Sleep comes fast. A few deep inhales and Molly's breathing becomes gentle and rhythmic as she nods off. Delphi is engrossed in making her mud cakes. Her rag doll lies dangerously close to the water's edge. The water laps at it. Delphi pats at the cakes and stops and is intrigued as she takes a closer look. They are moving, wriggling. The little girl's face fills with a frown of curiosity. The mud wriggles and the cakes lose their shape. She pats at them, trying to get them back to their roundness. Did she add too much water to her mix of mud and broken twigs? She stops, and there it is again. They wriggle. Delphi looks to concur with her rag doll, but it is gone. It floats out in the murky brown flood water. The river's current has picked up in pace and volume, and there is a distant rumbling, a cracking and tearing. Delphi becomes upset as she watches her dolly floating away. She looks towards her brothers and calls, "Denny!" and points to the doll floating towards them. Molly sleeps, but her eyelids begin to flicker. Has she heard Delphi? Has she felt the rumbling? Her face distorts. She is dreaming. Her eyelids continue to flicker as she tries to make sense of the impressionistic jumbled images, too obscure to see details, flashing before her mind's eye. Her breathing becomes shallow and quick. Her hands tense, grabbing at her dress over her pregnant belly. She mumbles something inaudible. The rumbling sound is getting louder and closer. The roar of her surroundings cuts through her nightmare and she sits bolt upright, looking around to get her bearings. Then she sees it. In the now swollen river, a massive boulder, well over 6 feet in height, rolls with the rushing floodwater. That's what is causing the tremor, the cracking and tearing, taking out anything that stands in its way. Her children's anxious voices are calling, cutting through the roar of the raging water. Molly scrambles to her feet, stumbling over her long, tattered dress skirt. She pulls Delphi back from the river's edge. "Move away, further up the bank." Delphi does as she's told. "Stay there." Standing on the bank of the river, they are stilled by the shock of what they see. The browning floodwater is flushing down from upstream, from further north, after all the heavy rains over the past few weeks. It is swirling around the base of the boulders where the boys stand. Joe Jr. points to the floodwater. "Snuck up on us, Ma! Get off the boulders and onto the bank, now!" The boys do as they are told. They understand the urgency in their Ma's voice, and they know the ways of Mother Nature. Floodwater comes quick and fast. Then Molly realizes Danny is not with them. She calls to them, "Danny, where's Danny?" I snap my head up and down the river looking for my eldest. The murky brown floodwater camouflages him. Danny's olive skin and sandy-coloured hair are lost in the rapidly rising water. And then I see where the other two are looking and pointing. With just the tips of his fingers, Danny clings to a boulder. The violent force of the water helps to keep him there. There is debris, a fallen tree from a previous flood, caught between two other boulders. This is probably saving Danny from being swept away. He holds Delphi's rag doll in his mouth and is hanging on for dear life. Time has slowed now. If I was a Christian, I'd thank the Lord. I whip my head around to see the massive boulder slowly inching its way downriver, causing a wave of turbulent whitewash that builds as it moves. The boulder is on a direct collision course with Danny. My frantic panic subsides and clarity arrives. I scream, "Hang on, Danny, hang on, son!" And then I plunge into the fast-moving water. But I slip. I reach out. I grasp at the water. No stability. I fall. And I'm quickly swept along with the current and forced under. No, no! Molly's three other children huddle together. They have worked their way up to Delphi. They look at where their mother has gone under, then glance at Danny. The boulder is almost upon him. He braces himself for the impact, knowing he's in trouble. He will be crushed. But just as the boulder rolls towards him, it hits something under the water and is turned ever so slightly. It collides with the debris, crushing it, breaking it into twigs, freeing it. In pieces, the tree floats away, taking Danny with it. Delphi lets out a blood-curdling scream that bounces around the mountain range and echoes back to slap the reality of this nightmare into each of their little faces. She knows this is all her fault. Tears spill from her eyes. Her little lips tremble. Under the water, I have lost all orientation. I don't know where up or down is. I need to find it soon. My lungs are burning. I try, damn it. I'm trying to find the surface, but I'm being tossed around like a rag doll myself. I'm being stabbed at by the debris under the water and the debris that floats on the surface. I'm trying to protect my belly, my unborn baby. Oh, no, my unborn baby. Then I am snagged by a branch. It brings me to a jolt and halt, and for a second, I see where up is. And I kick with all my might to swim to the surface, but I can't move. The tree branch has a tight hold on my skirt. I'm frantic now. I twist and turn, trying to break the branch or rip the material from it, but the movement only winds my dress tighter. My lungs scream for oxygen. My mind cries for my children. Danny! I have no choice but to try and breathe. Not that I want to open my mouth, but it's what my brain is telling my body to do. That's how you breathe. And by compulsion, my mouth gapes open and I breathe in. Water. I pull at my dress, but it refuses to give. I take in more water. My body starts to reject it. My mind suddenly becomes composed. I flutter my eyes to find focus. There, before me, floating before me, is a woman. A fair-skinned Aboriginal woman. Her native features strong in the contours of her face, her hair red, long, and swirling with the current like the velvet green weed stuck between the river rocks. She looks to be about 27 years old. A calmness comes over me. I'm mesmerized by the woman's deep, dark eyes. I stare at her as if nothing else matters. The look in her eyes tells me something. I tilt my head to understand her thoughts. She speaks to me, her eyes wide, knowing. She is willing me on, to fight, to live, my children. I reach for the Aboriginal woman just as the branch my dress is entwined on breaks. I am quickly swept away and the Aboriginal woman is gone too. Only a small piece of material remains, rippling with the movement of the current.